From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At West Point, President Obama on how America can, should, and will lead.
U.S. military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
Edward Snowden leaks a little more about Edward Snowden.
I was trained as a spy in sort of the traditional sense of the word, in that I lived and worked undercover overseas, pretending to work in a job that I'm not, and even being assigned a name that was not mine.
And at UC Santa Barbara after the shooting, processing that which cannot be processed, which is any part of it.
It really makes me feel grateful, you know, just to be doing the simplest things, because you never know what can happen, and you never know, you know, when those things that you enjoy so much doing, it can be taken away from you.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch from Politico, David Shepardson from the Detroit News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us from Washington, David Shepardson. He is Washington bureau chief for the Detroit News. David, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, John.
And also from Washington, Michael Hirsch joining us. He's national editor at Politico. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, Jack Beatty joins us. Hey, Jack.
Hello, John, David,
busy week. A lot of news, some of it even happening today. Michael, the president, going to earlier in the week, the president, in that foreign policy speech, much advertised, much talked about ahead of time, even leaked to some degree ahead of time, was billed as going to be big. You get the sense that when he went to West Point, he was going there to respond to a certain narrative that was already out there about Obama's foreign policy. What was that narrative?
Well, it's that he's presided over a weakening of America's presence in the world, a withdrawal, neo-isolationism. It goes by many names. I will say that the speech did not answer most of those concerns. It was broadly criticized for failing to articulate a coherent vision for America's role in the world, even as the president did repeat some of the time-honored phrases we've heard from him and previous presidents about...
Well, to your point, Michael, let's listen.
The question each of you will face, is not whether America will lead, but how we will lead. Not just to secure our peace and prosperity, but also extend peace and prosperity around the globe.
Yeah, Michael, as you say, he posed the question himself and then you don't feel he answered it.
No, but I mean, that's the criticism. I think that he gave a speech that is very well suited to his presidency. I mean, with a couple of years left to go, I think we can now say that this is a president who's going to be identified with the ending of two big wars, including America's longest war in Afghanistan, which he also made news about this week, and a retrenchment that Obama and his administration sees as a necessary corrective to what they saw as the overreaching of the Bush administration, the launching of, you know, what Obama himself, back when he was a state senator, called a dumb war in Iraq. This is his legacy, and I think he was laying it out in a fairly coherent way. But of course, it disappointed those who continue to push for a much more active American role in the world.
And David Shepardson, the interesting list put together by the Wall Street Journal of the major points of the Obama foreign policy from the past that were just missing from that speech. There was no mention of the reset with Russia, a situation that has moved dramatically since that idea was first proposed in 2009. The pivot to Asia wasn't talked about. The red line in Syria wasn't talked about. The Israeli-Palestinian process wasn't talked about. What does it say that so much was missing that was there in the past?
Well, I think, you know, to Michael's point, the speech really focused on the two looming issues that he inherited on, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, and this whole issue of when the country decides to go to war. And you're right, you know, a lot of these issues you just mentioned have not been, you know, very successful, or they have been stagnant, or, you know, have not worked in terms of the resets with either Russia or, you know, trying to pivot to Asia. So I think it was more narrowly focused, but, you know, they are still making a big effort to try to win, you know, big trade agreements with both most Pacific nations in Europe, which, you know, the administration thinks long term could help boost economic ties and be part of his foreign policy legacy.
And Jack Beatty, the New York Times did an editorial on the agenda, calling it vague. And after hearing what the president laid out, do you agree with that? And do you think that there actually is a clear policy, that it's not so vague?
Well, I don't think it's so vague. You know, the president did speak of the threat of terrorism, and he you know, really, I think was indicating that maybe that threat has grown during his watch. He spoke of the diffuse threat, and of meeting it by essentially following a kind of what President Nixon called Vietnamization, empowering our partners to fight the terrorists on their own soil. Of course, that sounds like a great idea. There are all sorts of problems with it, one of them being the primary one, being that the partners are often corrupt governments, which in their efforts to combat the terrorists will make more of them, witness Nigeria. Nevertheless, there was an idea there about where the threat is, not necessarily located in Afghanistan and Pakistan as in the past, now more diffuse all over, not directly threatening U.S. interests, but perhaps potentially, and how to deal with it through this idea of empowering partners.
Michael Hirsch, the president also this week talking about final troop withdrawals from Afghanistan by 2016, leaving behind really just a remnant force to protect the U.S. embassy and to continue doing some training of the Afghan military. Did that make this the his mission accomplished speech in that sense?
Well, that's a rather cruel illusion, I think. After all, he hasn't said anything like that. In fact, he lowered expectations, you know, saying that Afghanistan was never going to be perfect. In fact, this eliminates what had been feared among some Afghan elites and American officials who were working in Afghanistan, which was the so-called zero option, that because the bilateral security agreement was not being signed under current President Hamid Karzai, that the U.S. might threaten to leave at the end of 2014, which could have been, you know, really, really troublesome given the unready state of the Afghan security forces. From officials I've talked to during my visits there, 2016, 2017, certainly around that time, it's perceived that some 380,000 or so Afghan security and police forces might be ready to handle the Taliban on their own. So I think that this is at least this plan, which includes leaving 9,800 U.S. troops there until 2016, at least holds out the possibility of a hope that Afghanistan will not slide back into, a sort of al-Qaeda host state.
While we're still on foreign policy, let's bring in Bill, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Bill. You're on our program, On Point, and share with us your views on the foreign policy question.
Hi. I feel that President Obama is being very sophisticated and prudent, and it's so refreshing and invaluable to our future. Instead of jumping in with military might and bluster and other people's lives, he's talking about first building the partnerships, exhausting the diplomacy options, showing restraint, which makes us stronger. Then we have our military when there's really a clear-cut need. And I find it appalling that the Republicans are just having a knee-jerk criticism of him. He's just talking common sense. It's great leadership. And if other president, it's historic to see someone so wise and prudent, and he's not getting any of the credit that he deserves.
Well, let me step in there and take a little listen to something you're saying. We saw this week that John McCain, Arizona Republican and his one-time opponent for president, made a comment on Fox News on the issue of Syria, saying that, in fact, President Obama is allowing President Assad to cross that red line of chemical weapons. And because of that, he basically is calling President Obama unreliable.
America is not weak. America is unreliable. And that's why no one trusts us, whether it be in the Middle East or whether it be as far away as Japan, where all these countries are looking at the options without American leadership.
David Cheperson, in the minute we have left before our break, Bill's sort of saying that what he's hearing from the Republicans is not a principled position, but more politics as usual in an attempt to bring the president down. Does it sound that way to you?
Well, you know, I think it's the narrative the Republicans have been pushing, which is that, you know, the president can be rolled and that did not follow through either on Syria or was not tough enough with Vladimir Putin in Crimea. And I think the argument that the president's making, going back to his speech, I mean, is that, look at Afghanistan. It's easy to start a war. It's easy to begin a campaign. It's very difficult to get out, given that Afghanistan is already the country's longest war. And even though combat operations will be done, in theory, by the end of the year, there'll be almost 10,000 troops on the ground post 2015. So it's certainly something the Republicans would like, a more muscular foreign policy, certainly like the hawks in the Bush administration. But I think the president's trying to establish his legacy of
all right,
only going to go to war on court issues.
Let's have everybody all stand by. We're talking about this week in the news. We want to hear from you, and we're going to be talking shortly about the massacre in California and Edward Snowden calling himself a patriot. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is our Week in the News roundtable. So we know this awful story unfolded this weekend in Isla Vista, California. 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed six people, stabbing and shooting them, and then he killed himself. Apparently, he seemed to make clear he was targeting women whom he believed had rejected him. Jack, I want to get your take on whether this time it's different or not. But before we do that, let's listen to Richard Martinez. He's the father of one of the young men who died, Chris Martinez, who made a plea for stricter gun laws.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop?
You can hear so much in that man's voice and in that plea. And while I hear it and am touched by it, as everyone I think is, the thought also crosses my mind that we have heard that plea before, Jack, after events like this in the very recent past. Would this time make it different?
Probably not. The NRA rules, and it rules because, congressional fear, cravenness, as I think Mr. Gonzalez said, it's a bottomless commodity. The congressmen want to stay in office, and so they're going to continue to vote as they do. I do think there's something hopeful here, and that's a piece of legislation proposed by Republican Congressman Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania. He's the only clinical psychiatrist in Congress. And basically, he wants to rewrite the rules of this HIPAA, this act that essentially guarantees health insurance portability and accountability and so on. He wants to lower the threshold for institutionalizing people, or at least bringing them in for preliminary inquiries, who are a danger to themselves or others. And he goes through various permutations of this. As it is now, it's an extremely high bar. He wants to lower that, and he wants to apply much more quickly. And he even applies it to this particular, when you look at a nostrum, you say, well, how does it fit the latest atrocity?
Yeah,
Is it transparent? Well, this one seems to, because it would have given Mr. Rogers' parents the power to ask a court to order an emergency psychiatric evaluation, a right that's granted in 34 states, but not in California. This Congressman Murphy's bill would make that possible. It is a bipartisan bill. It has, I think, over 30 Democratic sponsors. It's rare you can look at one of these things and say, my God, if only.
Right.
Well, here we have it.
We have Robert calling in from Amesbury, Massachusetts. Robert, how do you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, hi. I applaud that poor father actually making a statement that took on the NRA and the spineless politicians who will do nothing about it. For too long, the extremists at the NRA have dictated the conversation on guns and have intimidated and bullied, as I say, the spineless members of Congress, both Democratic and Republican, who will do nothing about it.
Robert, you think that's all of the congressmen who would oppose gun control, or do you think some of them actually are doing it from principle?
No, I think a lot of them are just afraid. They want to keep their jobs, as if keeping their jobs, the world will stop if they lose their jobs. They can do something else. But Obama had the perfect opportunity to do something on guns after the tragedy at Sandy Hook. He could have pushed through something very fast while the NRA was on the ropes. But he formed yet another useless committee to study an issue that didn't need studying, and the NRA came back and blocked it.
Michael Hirsch, from Politico magazine, that's a pretty strong indictment from Robert. Is the conversation in Washington one of spinelessness?
Yeah, I would agree with that, fear of the NRA. To add to this conversation, I think Jack is right to point to some of the mental health related legislation that could possibly in the future, avert a terrible disaster like this. But the issue is guns, as the father of that victim so eloquently put it. There's a new book out by Michael Waldman called The Second Amendment, a biography, which I would recommend to your listeners, that goes into just how the NRA has manipulated this debate and the constitutional provision for gun ownership. It's absurd. It's never been separated from, what the founders called a well-organized militia. And the whole idea that there is some sacrosanct right to individual gun ownership without any restrictions on it is really a falsity in our history. And yet the political debate in Washington remains ossified and captured by this NRA lobbying money. And to get back to the caller's point, I think that Obama was rather helpless in terms of running up against a wall after Newtown when he tried to push through some of that gun legislation.
John, calling in from Charleston, South Carolina. John, what do you think of this part of this discussion, that it's a mental health, that mental health should be front and center in this discussion?
After actually sitting down and reading a bulk of the portion of this boy's manifesto he left, one of the things he goes into a lot of detail in is the things of his entire life. And it's very, very indicative, and especially coming from personal experience, having had a family member with a lot of the same type of emotional problems, that literally somehow it seems that every single person in this boy's life kind of either failed or ignored this very outward and overt and pervasive mental illness, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. all sorts of occurrences happening that you would think that one of the things would be, hey, we should, have you see a psychiatrist, and that never happened, on the part of the parents, of teachers, and the several different schools he bounced between, social counselors that they had sent him to for, trying to find a job, things like that, that what were obviously very outward signs of mental illness that either were failed to be recognized or just plain ignored. And I think it's a very scathing indictment in terms of the state of the mental health treatment and knowledge and awareness.
All right, John, thank you. John, thank you for your call. And I'm just cutting you off because I think you've made your point and made it well. And I want to go to another John calling from Morris, Connecticut. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
How are you? I might lose service soon, but the point I wanted to make is just like the battle with drugs. As far as people, you can make all the laws you want, but people are still going to obtain drugs. I'm a gun owner. I'm not a diehard NRA member at all. My kids grew up with guns, and we've never had a problem. But just to say that the politicians need to make more laws, they can make all the laws they want, I believe, and it's still, these things are going to happen. You could kill 10 people with a knife in a movie theater very quickly, too. So, you can't just ban knives also. So right. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, are you going to brand people with mental health problems since the day they're born? Or, I mean, how are you going to keep track of the, systematically, do they have everybody have to go for a yearly scheduled appointment to get their mental evaluation?
All right, John, let me jump in just because I want to keep things moving along, but thanks for bringing that note to this conversation. David Shepperson, let's move on to Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden made an appearance, a little bit of a surprise appearance, but to the delight of NBC News this weekend, who had him exclusively, an interview with Brian Williams. Let's sit down and listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
I don't think there's ever been any question that I'd like to go home. I mean, I've from day one said that I'm doing this to serve my country. Now, whether amnesty or clemency ever becomes a possibility is not for me to say. That's a debate for the public and the government to decide. But if I could go anywhere in the world, that place would be home.
David Shepperson, what are his odds of coming home?
Well, it's certainly possible he comes home, but if he does, he's going to be arrested, and he's facing serious felony charges, and the administration has given no indication that they're willing to bargain with him and would be likely seeking a life sentence for the obvious reason that they want to send a message to any other would-be leakers. Now, the interesting thing Edward Snowden said is he does not have any of the classified material. He didn't bring them to Russia, and it seems that one of his big bargaining chips would be the return of the material in exchange for the United States treating him more leniently. But given that these documents are in the hands of journalists, and it's unlikely that they would return these documents, it's not clear what is his incentive, or what's the government's incentive to cut him a deal, aside from him explaining in detail what exact documents he took, because the government still doesn't know.
Well, indicative of your point that he'll probably face arrest and charges leading to a potential life sentence seems to be shored up by Secretary of State John Kerry's remarks in reaction to Snowden.
The bottom line is, this is a man who has betrayed his country, who is sitting in Russia, an authoritarian country, where he has taken refuge. He should man up and come back to the United States. If he has a complaint about what's the matter with American surveillance, come back here and stand in our system of justice and make his case.
Now, Jack Beatty, an interesting thing about the whole story of Snowden is that there is the counter narrative that he actually what he did was a statement of courageous civil disobedience, certainly not subscribed to by everybody, but by a lot of people. And, just looking at some of what we've heard on Facebook from listeners this morning, we have Chris, very simple, short, Snowden equals hashtag patriot. You hear from John Kerry that that the administration is impervious to that side of the narrative. But what is your take on that, the competition between these two versions of Edward Snowden and what he did? Which side is winning?
Well, I don't know what the polls say. My own view is that if Snowden could come back, could work out a deal whereby he could make his case in court, that might actually, who knows whether he'd get off, but it would certainly mitigate the sentence. And the trouble with the Espionage Act under which he's charged is that it doesn't allow for the kind of plea that he would want to enter. It's a very dubious law going back to 1917, passed in the domestic hysteria of World War I. And if he could come back and make his case and say, now, I have exposed the greatest threat to American, liberty or the Fourth Amendment since who knows what. I have exposed what Judge Leone, the federal judge, says it would make the founding fathers spin in their graves if they knew. I have told the world. If he had just sort of pointed to all the things that have originated from his exposure, the congressional hearings, the efforts to make things more transparent, the FISA business, all the rest, he could say, and I'm now to be, aren't these constructive things? Aren't our liberties more secure? Didn't I help bring that about? It seems to me that's a very powerful plea.
Let's bring in Will from Charlotte, North Carolina. Will, welcome to the program. What are you thinking?
Thank you, John. Yeah, I think what the last caller just said, I really enjoyed listening to him. and I agree, except that I do believe that our country's not going to get any better as far as the security of our communication. I think actually our government's learned a lesson, and they'll just be a little more clandestine about it. But I don't know that Snowden's 100% innocent, but he's definitely not a villain. I'm very happy for what he's done. I support him, and I'm just really proud of him as an American that he's come forward and exposed things that not only was our government doing to its own citizens, but to citizens all around the world. And I really believe that he's hiding under the cloud of terrorism to do all of it.
But you don't hear in John Kerry's voice an honest conviction that, that Snowden did an enormous amount of damage to the to U.S. intelligence operations?
Not a bit. I supported John Kerry whenever the Republicans went after him for the when he went to Vietnam. At least he got up and went. I mean, he showed a man to go. He might have came back early. I have no idea. But I don't support Kerry and his foreign policies at all, and I don't believe he's speaking the truth whenever he's speaking. And I'm really kind of disappointed in President Obama for not.
I think you need to buckle your seatbelt is what it sounds like to me, and I'm getting worried.
I just did, but I think I wish he would have been a little more supportive of Snowden, because I thought whenever he was running for president, and just for the way his demeanor is, I would have felt that he would have, if he was still a senator and still working in the law, constitutional law, I believe he would have been also would have liked to have shaken Snowden's hand. If they just wouldn't persecute the man, let him come on back home and air out his grievances and turn his documents over, I believe things would work out better.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. I want to go to Dan in New Orleans. Hi, Dan. You're on point.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
My point would be Snowden, it seems like he should be an American hero for just, 90% of the people that live here. Of course, the government is business now, and, of course, their business is control, so the people that control everything don't like anything that he says, but to the people that should be going into the streets and, say, bring Snowden home.
Yeah.
It seems like to me.
All right, Dan, thank you. Thank you for your point, and I want to interrupt you to bring it to Michael Hirsch before we come up to the break. Again, it's more or less the question I put to Jack Beatty is that, this is entirely unscientific, but three people in a row have had very positive views of Snowden and what he did. That makes no difference back in Washington?
Well, it does make some difference. And obviously Snowden in his interview with NBC was kind of making the same kind of plea for clemency, saying he had done a service to his country and he was a patriot. But there's a lot to be said for John Kerry's point of view as well. This is a guy who betrayed his oath. There was a debate this week over whether he had ever attempted to do any internal make an internal complaint to the NSA so as to do this without publicly disclosing these documents. And the NSA said no, he hadn't. And Snowden insisted in an email to the Washington Post that he had more documents proving that he had. But people see the NSA as this great evil Big Brother type surveillance state. In fact, despite all of this hue and cry, there is no evidence whatsoever that the NSA or the intelligence community ever misused any of this information they were supposedly overhearing or mopping up from emails violate the rights of an American. I mean, we tend to forget about that. It was always about potential misuse. And at the same time, it does seem as if, they've helped to keep us safe. So I think we ought to have a little bit of perspective here.
All right, Michael, David, Jack, hang on. We're going to be back after the break. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, a landslide victory for Egypt's new president, former Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. It has been a controversial ride, but voters did not hold back in their support.
It's like a big festivity. It's we cannot believe that we've reached this day after so many obstacles and so many terrorists.
You've probably heard of Google's self-driving car, but this week they rolled out a brand new version. No gas pedal, no steering wheel, just sit down in it and ride. A few lucky passengers got to try it out.
You sit, relax, you don't need to do nothing. It knows when it needs to stop, it knows when it needs to go.
It actually rides better than my own car.
Yes, sure.
And literary giant and poet Maya Angelou died at 86. Her words spoke truth for a nation of all stripes. In 1999, she said there is a bit of herself in everything she's ever written.
When I approach a poem, I hope to give something out of my own years of struggle and success and failure and things that go bump in the night.
We are joined by David Shepardson from the Detroit News, Michael Hirsch from Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. David, we had some unsettling news yesterday, I would say, that the U.S. economy is back to shrinking. It actually shrunk in the first quarter of the year by 1%. Is that just an artifact of a cold winter, or is something deeper going on there? How concerned should the average American be?
I think people should be concerned. You know, we're not in a recession. That would be two quarters of negative GDP growth. But, you know, the economy has slowly been recovering for almost 5 years. But there are some troubling signs. You know, the unemployment rate has dropped dramatically, but still it's far above historically average levels. The housing recovery has not done as much as analysts would have thought to broaden the overall economy. And there's still the big issue of flat wages, higher productivity, but in general, Americans are not American wages are not keeping up with somewhat rising costs, although inflation has been, you know, largely in check. But it just shows that the deep recession the U.S. Was in 2008 through 2009, it was going to take a long time to recover, and until we get back to, you know, historically normal levels, it could be several years. That's why we still have, you know, extremely low lending rates by the Federal Reserve to continue to try to spur, you know, more growth in housing. But by no means should people, I think, be happy with the state of the economy, because it still has a long way to go.
But at the same time, is it something that we have to accept as our present normal?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, these are some fundamental questions people are grappling with. You know, factory workers, the manufacturing sector in the U.S. is now down to less than 9% of total jobs. That's the lowest level it's been since World War II. The U.S. predicts over the next 10 years that we'll shed another 500,000 factory jobs. These are jobs that people traditionally with only high school diplomas could go out and make a decent living, especially in the Midwest. And a lot of those jobs are gone and are paying much less. So the country does have to grapple with how do we create good-paying jobs, how do we improve education to ensure that, you know, that the next generation is doing as well as their parents did.
And Michael Hirsch, national editor for Politico magazine, against what David was just saying, we have the stock market going up, but is that just because the stock market never really has much to do with the economy?
It seems less and less related, particularly to the problems of inequality, the disappearing middle class, which David was just alluding to, and the fact that wages for the middle class have not kept up with productivity gains, or where the stock market's going. I mean, the overarching problem here, one that's brought into relief by a very slow growing economy, and indeed, you know, just now in the last quarter, a decreasing growth economy, is that this inequality is just getting worse. And it's, you know, there are no real solutions here. I mean, it was a bad winter, and that can explain some of this data, but it also comes at a time of decreasing expenditures by state and local governments, not as much of a stimulus by the federal government as probably should have been done in the lingering aftermath of the Great Recession. You have completely the wrong debate going on in Washington over austerity, in other words, mm-hmm. at a time when the economy still needs a pick-me-up from this historically devastating financial crisis of 2008.
Let's bring in Andrew from Omaha, Nebraska. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hey, hi.
Hi. What are you thinking?
Just a quick remark on General Shinseki. I'm a retired veteran, an Army sergeant. And, I mean, the VA has been quite a drag for a lot of us. And I think that maybe the best thing to do is, though I kind of support him as a vet, is for General Shinseki to kind of step out and have some fresh blood come in and see if they can be able to get to the bottom of what has been going on.
All right, Andrew, I'm going to use that as a transition point in our conversation, and thank you for making it as we go to air. The question is whether Eric Shinseki has much of a future remaining to him as Secretary for Veterans Affairs. David, we had this report come out from the Inspector General that looked into the scandal of whether the Veterans Administration was covering up the amount of waiting times, the amount of time that veterans had to wait actually to get treatment. How damning was this report? Tell us what was in it.
It was very damning. You know, it showed that the average wait was, in some cases, was over 100 days for a first appointment, and that VA officials would game the system by essentially, you know, inputting into the computer 0 wait days, depending on when that first visit was. And it's clear that there was a systemic failure to accurately record when people were when veterans were getting first treated. And you know, the issue, which has not yet been resolved, is whether, you know, as many as 24 deaths of veterans may be the result of not being seen in a timely fashion. And you know, beyond the future of, you know, the VA secretary, you know, there's now broader bipartisan support for letting veterans use private hospitals and private medical care, given the wait times. And you know, you have to. It seems like, you know, it's rare that there's any consensus in Washington these days, but it seems like there's going to be a dramatic push for reforms. You know, this is a problem that surfaced in the Bush administration. President Obama, then candidate Obama, you know, said he would address it strongly over 5 years ago. It's clear that you know, both parties have had trouble dealing with the massive surge in veterans and new individuals coming to the system post Iraq and Afghanistan who need services. And you know, it's, you know, beyond the government's been hiking the budget every year. It's
right.
That they haven't done enough to resolve the systemic problem.
Right. And Jack, on this panel last week, you discussed this issue at length. But the depth of the scandal, the word scandal now just applies with absolute clarity and certainty and specificity. This how is this thing now reverberating through Washington?
Well, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing, and the president is responsible, Shinseki, back and forth. We hear the Democrats saying, well, the Republicans filibustered a bill that would have put $28 billion more into the veteran system. Well, who knows the truth of that? What I'm struck with is just, I mean, here's the Times this morning. Doctor shortage is cited in delays. Here are the statistics. The past 3 years, primary care appointments gone up 50%. Doctors, only 9%. Now, they're supposed to see 1,200 patients. They're seeing 2,000. You know, didn't someone see that was a structural problem? They were going to go up 50% on because of changes that the president made, you know, to his credit. They were going to, you know, Agent Orange, all sorts of things. They were going to lower the standards not lower the standards, but make it easier for veterans to get in. And that was all, you know, all to the good. But didn't someone say, wait a minute, we have to increase the number of doctors, or else there are going to be long lines? And it's just really, you know, and the question of how do you increase the number of doctors? Well, they quote experts saying, well, you got to pay them more. Well, wouldn't that be a good investment? Yeah. I mean, it's just extraordinary to me that something that basic wasn't thought through.
Michael, let's take a look at elections. We had two notable elections overseas this week, Ukraine and Egypt. Ukraine, let's look at this one first. What's remarkable is, number one, that the election happened with the threat of violence, but number two is the violence that we have seen since the election. The government in Kiev stepped up its offensive against pro-Russian separatist forces. Yesterday on Ukrainian television, acting president Alexander Turchynov announced that pro-Russian rebels shot down a Ukrainian military helicopter near Slovyansk.
I have just received information from the area near Slovyansk that terrorists with Russian weapons, PZRK, have shot our helicopter carrying soldiers for rotation. 14 of our soldiers died, including General Kulchitsky.
Michael, I mean, nobody's using the term civil war, but they're shooting at each other. Where do you see this thing going?
Well, it remains, you know, at a very, very dangerous cusp of potentially civil war, greater violence. even Russian invasion, although it does seem in recent days that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has gradually edged back from a threat of invasion, pulled back troops. Of course, Putin, being an old KGB colonel, has been sowing a lot of mischief internally, using Russian soldiers, acting undercover, pretending to be Ukrainians who are separatists. It's difficult to say, and of course, with a newly elected president, it's difficult to say whether he even has the broader support of the country, in particular the east part, where there is a lot of separatist sentiment. So this continues to be a low, simmering, violent situation that could easily flare up, you know, at any moment,
and David,
into a civil war.
David Shepardson, this leads us back to the foreign policy question, Obama administration. How is the White House responding to what's happening in Ukraine?
Well, I think fairly cautiously. They resisted calls early on to provide more direct military assistance and, have taken some steps, pressuring, U.S. business leaders to boycott a conference in Russia, stepping up sanctions on some, Russian individuals, and sort of trying to turn up the economic pain that Russia faces, canceling various joint efforts, refusing to take part in certain summits and meetings and so on. But, the administration would argue there are not a lot of good options. The United States isn't planning to invade militarily or to take an active role in ousting Russia from the Crimea. And, given the geopolitical issues involving natural gas and its impact on Europe, and European, worries about, being too tough on Russia. It's similar to the approach that the administration's taken with other difficult challenges.
Speaking of difficult challenges, then we have again the situation in Egypt, where again the administration's position has seemed somewhat muddled, if not varied. This week, presidential election, only two candidates, General al-Sisi, who said he would never run, ran. He won, but not with the enormous show of support that he wanted. The turnout was incredibly low. Michael, how legitimate is this presumed election of al-Sisi?
Not very, obviously. His government claims that the opposition, such as it was, only got 2%. I mean, this is like a classic autocratic show election, and I guess the ultimate irony here really is kind of mind-boggling. Is that several years after the beginning of the Arab Spring, when many secular Egyptian protesters, gathered in Tahrir Square, passionately calling for the resignation of the last military-engendered autocrat, which is Hosni Mubarak, here we are seemingly back to square one. And in fact, the only real difference that one can see between Sisi and Mubarak in his early days as a general come president is that Sisi's cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood in a much more harsh way than Mubarak did, even though he cracked down. I mean, it's really just an awful sort of sense of retrenchment in Egypt and perhaps in the Arab Spring in general, because instead of, liberal secular democracy, what we've seen is Islamist groups rising in places like Libya. It's creating a very, very messy situation and one that is not terribly inspiring.
Jack, the Pope made a trip to the Holy Land this week. He went to two walls. He went to the Western Wall and he went to the wall dividing the occupied territories, the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, people have different names for it, from Israel, as recognized by the United States. And some people thought his visit to that second wall made him look rather sympathetic to the Palestinians. How did you read it?
Well, I think it did. But on the other hand, his visit to the grave of or shrine to Theodor Herzl, the father of Zionism, showed an endorsement or at least an affirmation of the Jewish nature of the Jewish state. And I think that must have been very much appreciated by Mr. Netanyahu. One of his big issues is that that's one of the things the Palestinians must recognize, that Israel is a Jewish state. They say they will not. And the Pope going to Herzl's, I'm not sure what it was exactly, monument, that's a state I think that the Israelis must have liked.
What was this dispute that very briefly flared up between the Pope and Prime Minister Netanyahu about what language Jesus spoke?
Well, you know, my answer on this is always the one that given by the apocryphal Arkansas school principal of years ago. They said, someone said, shouldn't there be Chinese taught in, or French, I think it was, taught in your school system? He said, listen, if English was good enough for Jesus, it should be good enough for the people of Arkansas.
Yeah, so what happened was Prime Minister Netanyahu said Jesus spoke Hebrew, and the Pope said, no, he spoke Aramaic. And then Netanyahu's response was, well, he spoke both, which maybe was the diplomatic answer. Yeah. David Shepardson, I want to thank you for joining us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, John.
And Michael Hirsch from Politico, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, John.
And Jack Beattie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, Room to Grow is the new GOP manifesto to win middle-class voters. We will drill down on its content. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. He is back next week. And this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.